when looking at a passage for the first time and trying to assess what perhaps its main theme is, it's always useful to look out for recurring refrains. And of course we have one refrain in this passage, don't we, that's used at the start of the chapter and again at the end of the chapter: we do not lose heart. That, I think, is a major theme throughout this epistle. It's an epistle in which Paul is far more personal than in many, if not most, of his epistles. He really wears his heart on his sleeve in 2 Corinthians, and he's very open and very candid about his struggles and about his sufferings. And reading then the catalogues, and at times it is like a catalogue, isn't it, of afflictions and difficulties and struggles, you would expect Paul to be losing heart. But twice, as I say, in this chapter, he assures us, we do not lose heart. And again then, there's this kind of tension throughout the epistle. All this suffering, and yet somehow Paul keeps emerging and saying things like this: we do not lose heart. And it's in that connection then that we come to the well-known final section of the chapter, which I would particularly like us to focus on this morning, verses 16 to 18. So we do not lose heart, though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. And as we look at that paragraph, I would particularly like to notice four things this morning. First of all, a process. A process. Verse 16 there, in the middle of the verse, Paul says, our outer self is wasting away. Our outer self is wasting away. Now we need to immediately clarify then, don't we? What is our outer self? What is my outer self? What is your outer self? Well, it's not the same as your old self. Because, of course, that's another phrase that Paul uses from time to time in his epistles, isn't it? Several times he refers to your old self. And your old self, then, in Paul's terminology, is your pre-Christian self, your pre-conversion self, the person you were before you were in Jesus Christ. That's your old self. And, of course, when you're a Christian, your old self isn't wasting away. Paul is quite clear in Romans chapter 6, verse 6, for instance, that your old self was crucified. It's already dead. It's not wasting away. There's no kind of gradual dying process going on with your old self. Your old self has been killed, he says. It's been crucified with Jesus Christ. Or as he puts it in Colossians 3, verse 9, it's been put off. There it's kind of clothing imagery. It's been divested. It's been taken off you. Your old self has gone. And I think it's very important, and we'll touch on this perhaps this evening, it's very important that we fully grasp that as Christians, that our old self has been crucified with Christ. In Paul's theology, in Paul's thinking, it has been killed. So he's not here talking about our old self wasting away. No, he says our outer self is wasting away. So what is our outer self? Well, our outer self then is our body and our mind. That part of us with which the medical profession is interested. It's our physical and mental dimension. That is the outer self that Paul is talking about. And what then is this wasting away? What does he mean then when he says that this outer self, this physical and mental part of us, is wasting away? Well, he's talking about then the result of the curse, isn't he, in Genesis chapter 3. You remember how there in Genesis 3, after Adam had eaten that fruit, remember one of the many things that God said in response was this, that you are dust, and to dust you will return. In other words, you will die. And I don't think that Genesis 3:19 there just means that at the point of actual death, your dust will return to dust. But your dust is returning to dust. This is an ongoing process throughout life. You are dying. You are wasting away. Paul puts it very strikingly in Romans chapter 8, verse 10. He says, the body is dead because of sin. He doesn't say that the body will one day be dead. The body is one day going to die. He says the body is dead. In other words, already death is at work in our bodies. Already, in the language of this text here, we are wasting away. And that then sometimes is very conspicuous through illness and disease and serious medical conditions. But at other times, perhaps it's more inconspicuous and just gradual and imperceptible, isn't it? Our appearance changes as we get older. We begin to forget things. We slow down. We find life just more toilsome and harder. And that then is this wasting away, this process, this ongoing decline that Paul is talking about. And how then does he view this process? What does he think about it? Well, notice he views it negatively. He refers to it in verse 17 as this affliction. There in verse 17, when he uses the word affliction, he's talking about the same thing he's described in verse 16 as this wasting away process. So what he describes in verse 16 as this wasting away, he describes in verse 17 as this affliction. So in other words, he doesn't just view this kind of this process of degeneration and decline physically and mentally. He doesn't view this as just a kind of necessary component of evolutionary biology, and we've just got to, you know, get on with it to make the best of it. It's in fact something that is natural, and it's part of who we are, and it has a certain dignity about it. He doesn't say anything like that. He sees this as bad, as negative. He sees this as something which shouldn't be. We weren't originally created by God to waste away. We weren't originally created by God to spend our lives dying and being pulled toward the dust. Now, this is something which, as I said a moment ago, has come in because of sin, because of the fall. It's part of God's curse. It's an affliction, he says. It's bad, it's ugly, it's regrettable, it's lamentable. It's something we shouldn't just say, oh, well, it's natural, it's part of the natural cycle of life. It's something that never should have been. He views it in a very bleak light. He calls it this affliction. And so that then is the sober note on which we must begin this morning, noting this process that Paul describes here. You see, whatever the Christian gospel is, it certainly is not this. Come to Jesus Christ and you will be healthy and wealthy and prosperous. No physical ailments, bodily and mentally 100%. Now here's Paul, and he's a Christian, and he's writing to Christians, and he's saying we are wasting away. We are wasting away. This is how far away Paul is from being a health and wealth preacher. He says, we are wasting away, we're declining, we're dying. Our bodies are dead. We are being pulled toward the grave. And as those then who are committed to a biblical worldview, we need to be absolutely clear on this process. At the outset this morning, Paul says, outwardly, in our outer self, we are wasting away. But secondly, notice not only a process, but a prospect. A prospect. Because you might think then that, well, if we're in the process of wasting away, the only prospect we have is being finally fully wasted away. Being finally dead. Surely, if this is the process we're in the grip of, then that's the only prospect we have. But no, Paul here describes a prospect that couldn't be more different from that. It's one word there in verse 17, glory. For Christians, Paul says, the prospect beyond this process of wasting away is glory. Now, glory, as many of you will know, is one of Paul's favourite words when he comes to talk about the Christian's future existence. And I think sometimes perhaps we use the word quite vaguely, not really giving much definition to what we mean. But when Paul uses this word glory about the Christian's future existence, he's not being vague and indefinite. He's being quite specific and concrete. He's talking primarily about the resurrection of the body, about our resurrected and transformed bodies. When Jesus Christ returns, they will be made glorious. Glory will, if you like, be poured into these bodies of ours. And that then is the glory that he has in view. That, I think, is implicit here in our text. Because if then, when we are tempted to despair about what is happening now to our bodies, their wasting away process, if when we are tempted to despair about that, the answer is to focus on the prospect of glory, then presumably that glory is going to be manifested in the same sphere where the wasting away is now taking place. If the glory is going to be in some different kind of sphere to where the wasting away is taking place, then it's not really much of a consolation. But no, Paul is saying that the two things belong to the same sphere. We are wasting away bodily, and we are going to receive glory bodily. So I think it's implicit here in our text, and of course it's explicit elsewhere in Paul's writings, and especially in the passage that we just sang, Romans 8 and verses 18 to 30. Remember how that great text, it begins and ends with reference to glory. So it begins Romans 8:18, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. You notice similar language to here, isn't it? Not worth comparing, the whole idea of comparing sufferings and glory. So glory is mentioned there in Romans 8:18, and then in Romans 8:30, those he predestined, he also called. Those he called, he also justified. Those he justified, he also glorified. So that text, 18 to 30, begins with glory, ends with glory. And the focal kind of verse in between is verse 23, where the glory is defined. What is it that we are waiting for? What is this glory? The redemption, Paul says, of our bodies. I.e. the resurrection. That's the glory. That's where the glory is going to be poured. That's where it's going to be lavished. That's where it's going to be bestowed, in these very bodies presently wasting away. So Paul then is saying that the Christian's prospect beyond this wasting process is nothing less than bodily resurrection. Glory. Now, I said a moment ago that the whole logic of our text demands then that both the glory and the affliction, the future glory and the present affliction, belong to the same sphere, namely the bodily sphere. But I think Paul, in our text here, relates the two things, the future glory and the present affliction, in two more specific ways. Let's just notice them quickly. Number one, he says that the glory is actually produced by the affliction. That's striking, isn't it? He says that this light momentary affliction is preparing, or better, producing for us an eternal weight of glory. And the word then, as I say, its basic meaning is produce. The affliction is producing the glory. Now in Romans 5:3, Paul says that our affliction, same word, is producing, same word, perseverance in us. Now that makes sense, doesn't it? You can see how our afflictions might produce perseverance, stamina, endurance in us. But how on earth can our afflictions produce glory? How can there be a causal connection between our present wasting away and the glory that's to come? How can our declining states actually produce our future glorious states? Well, again, I think the answer is in Romans 8. Remember there in Romans 8, in that passage, Paul talks then about our present sufferings, or the sufferings of this present age. And remember how there in Romans 8, he assigns to our present sufferings a dual significance. Number one, he says they are penal sufferings. So as I mentioned before, they are God's curse, aren't they, on this world. He says there in verse 20 that God subjected the world to frustration. That was in Genesis 3. That's the curse. God subjected this world to its present suffering and frustration. So our sufferings, they are penal sufferings. They are because we are a sinful race, because we have departed from God and rebelled against him through our forefather Adam. So they are penal sufferings, but then secondly, interestingly, he says they are prenatal sufferings. They are birth pains. They're in verse 22 of the same chapter. He says that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. So you walk around the RVI and you stop outside a ward and you hear screams coming from that ward, and that's ominous, you feel. You walk a bit further, stop outside another ward, you hear screams coming from there, and it's ominous. You go a bit further, stand outside another ward, hear screams in there, it's ominous. But then you go and you stand outside the maternity unit and you hear screams and expressions of pain coming from there. And the pain's no less real, perhaps, than in the other instances. But in this case, it's not so ominous because you know what's going on. You know that those pains are birth pains and that they're producing this joyful reality. Babies are being born. And Paul is saying there in Romans 8 that the sufferings, the fractures in this universe, and indeed the fractures in our bodies and minds as believing people, they are like those screams, those cries of pain. They are the precursor to what's coming in the future. They are birth pains. They are, in that sense, producing what is to come, producing the resurrection that is coming. They are not, our sufferings are not ominous, because they have this prenatal significance. They are producing the resurrection reality to come. So that's, I think, what he's getting at, where he talks about the glory being produced by the sufferings. But then he also makes it clear, doesn't he? Secondly, that the glory towers over the affliction. The glory towers over the affliction. So a series of contrasts. The affliction is momentary, he says. The glory is eternal. In other words, our afflictions, our struggles, our sufferings, they continue for, at the most, 80, 90, 100 years. But the glory, the resurrection body, it will go on for ages without end. It will exist as long as God himself will exist. Such a disproportion in terms of duration. Then again, he says that the affliction is light, whereas the glory, he says, is weighty. He's saying that our afflictions, our struggles, our sufferings, they are flimsy. They are insubstantial. Now, they don't seem flimsy and insubstantial at the minute, do they? They seem terribly weighty. But he's saying by comparison, proportionately, they are nothing. They're like feathers that blow away in a tiny little breeze compared to the resurrection reality, which will be so weighty, so substantial, so robust, so big, so grand, so hefty. And then in fact, he basically concedes, doesn't he, that even the whole idea of trying to compare the two realities is ridiculous, when he then just concludes it's beyond all comparison. You can't really compare, he's saying, our present sufferings with our future glory. They are just of a different order altogether. It's ridiculous even trying to identify points of comparison. Our resurrection existence will be incomparably greater than our present struggles are. And so that then is the Christian's prospect. That's your prospect if you're a believer this morning. Yes, at the minute, as much as anybody else, you are wasting away. As much as every unbeliever, you are wasting away. You're in that process, in the grip of it. But unlike unbelievers, you have a prospect. And that prospect is glory, resurrection glory, on the day that Jesus Christ returns. A process, a prospect. Thirdly, however, a preoccupation. A preoccupation. Look then at verse 18, where now the language of glory disappears, and instead we have this phrase, things that are unseen. I think that's the equivalent. So what he described as glory in verse 17, he now describes as things that are unseen in verse 18. Now, he's not saying then that our future glory, our future resurrection bodies are inherently invisible. Of course, they're not going to be invisible. His point is that they are presently unseen. They can't be seen yet. It's what Peter says, isn't it, in 1 Peter 1:5, that we wait for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. So there's going to be a great unveiling at the end, and that hasn't happened yet. And we can't yet see anything physically of our future glory. All we can see at the minute is this, what we are now in our current wasting away situation. At the moment, it's unseen. But the point here then in verse 18 is that Paul is not merely restating what he said in verse 17. He's not merely restating the fact that this is our prospect, that we have the prospect of resurrection glory. The emphasis here in verse 18 is on what we do with that prospect. And what we do with it, Paul says, is this: we look to it. We look to the things that are unseen. Now, that sounds a bit strange. How on earth do you look at that which is unseen? If it isn't here yet, if it hasn't happened yet, then how can we look at it? Well, of course, what he means is we anticipate it. We look forward to it. As Peter puts it in 1 Peter 1:13, we set our hope fully on the grace to be given us when Jesus Christ is revealed. We make this our preoccupation. And notice that actually, in order to do that, we also have to have a depreoccupation. I don't know if that's a word, but we have to not look at certain things. He says we look not to the things that are seen. In other words, we mustn't become preoccupied with our present wasting away, with this process that's now going on. We can just become preoccupied with that and get ever so depressed and down and discouraged about it and despondent. Look what's happening to me. I'm getting older and I'm getting weaker and I'm getting slower and it's all so miserable and dire. I'm at the doctor's twice a week. I take a mountain of pills every morning. It's just so depressing. And Paul is saying, don't look to those things. Look to the unseen realities to come. Look to the resurrection that's around the corner. Look to the glory that's on the horizon when Jesus Christ returns. Be preoccupied with that, not with this. And of course, what perhaps isn't emphasized here, but is emphasized in Romans 8 again, is the connection with Jesus Christ. Because of course, there are many passages, aren't there, which speak of us looking forward, longing for Jesus to be revealed, longing for him to come. And you might think, well, surely that's a much better preoccupation than being preoccupied with our resurrection glory to come. But in the last analysis, there's no dichotomy, is there, between the two things? As Paul makes clear in Romans 8, why is it that we long for our own resurrection glory? It's because we want to be like our elder brother Jesus. He's already received his resurrection glory. And on that day, he will be the firstborn among many brothers, Paul says there in Romans 8. We want to be like him. Perhaps some of you have had that experience at the earthly level. You've had older siblings, and you wanted to be like them. You wanted to wear the same clothes. You wanted to do the same sports, the same hobbies. You wanted to be like your older brother or sister. And it's because we want to be like our older brother Jesus that now we live the life of holiness. And it's because we want to be like our older brother Jesus that we can't wait even bodily to be like him. We can't wait till the day when actually physically we will look like him. Our bodies will be as glorious as his body, as Paul puts it in Philippians 3:21. And so, we desire Jesus, and we desire resurrection, and we desire resurrection because we desire Jesus. That's the logic, I think, of Romans 8. So is this your preoccupation if you're a believer this morning? It seems so obvious, doesn't it, that it would be. If our prospect is really as great as this, if really these wasting away bodies of ours are going to be resurrected and transformed and made, as Paul puts it in 1 Corinthians 15, 42-44, glorious bodies, powerful bodies, imperishable bodies, if that's really going to happen, surely this would preoccupy us. And yet, strangely, it doesn't a lot of the time, does it? We're so easily distracted. We're so easily far more despondent about our present bodies than thrilled by the prospect of our future bodies. What a wonderful preoccupation this is, to be able to say with Paul, we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. So a process, a prospect, a preoccupation. Fourthly and finally, a paradox. A paradox. Now, I've sometimes commented in the past that as human beings we are psychosomatic creatures, that is to say, we are soul and body unities. We aren't just souls, we are bodies as well. We aren't just bodies, we are souls as well. And the two dimensions to our existence, then, they're not just kind of awkwardly appended to each other, but there is a profound connection between our souls and our bodies, so that then what is going on in our bodies will often then affect what goes on in our souls and vice versa. So as I think I've applied it in the past, if we are not, for instance, looking after our bodies in terms of sleep, in terms of rest, if we are exhausting ourselves bodily, then that may well, I think, have an effect on our souls, and we're unlikely to be in great condition in our souls if we are carelessly allowing ourselves to be bodily exhausted. But of course, we must be careful about taking that logic too far, because we've just established this morning that we are inevitably in a process of wasting away outwardly, bodily. And that being the case, then, you'd have thought the obvious corollary of that would be that inwardly, in our souls, we would be declining as well. If our bodies affect our souls, then, and our bodies are wasting away, then there's inevitably going to be a process of decline in our souls also. But notice that in verse 16, Paul reverses that, doesn't he? And he establishes this paradox. You know what a paradox is? Two seemingly contradictory things being brought together. And he says there that though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed, he says. Our inner self is being renewed. There's not a commensurate decline going on in our souls as believers. No, he says the reverse. There's renewal going on in our souls. And I think then this is connected to the preoccupation we've just been talking about. And it's then as we are preoccupied with our glorious prospect, as we focus on future glory, that inevitably has an invigorating effect on our souls. It enlivens us, it animates us. As we hope and as we desire and as we long for Jesus to return, as we long to see him face to face, as we long to embrace him and know him like we have never known him before, and as we long for the resurrection that he will then give to us, that has this enlivening and animating effect on our souls. So that even as, yes, outwardly we are declining, inwardly we are being renewed. And it's striking that it's day by day, isn't it? This is a daily renewal. Not a kind of vague general trajectory moving in that direction. Daily renewal. Because we're so preoccupied with our future glory. That's a daily preoccupation. And so the renewal in our souls that goes with that is a daily thing also. And it's beautiful, isn't it, when you see this? I'm sure we've all seen it in people. We've seen it in our Christian brothers and sisters who, amidst the worst kind of wasting away, perhaps the last kind of wasting away, as they approach death itself, have not been embittered, have not become resentful, not become obnoxious, but on the contrary, have become brighter and more vibrant and more lovely in their souls, in their spirits, even as their bodies have crumbled to pieces. Something that we should pray for ourselves, isn't it? And it's something that we should pray for each other, especially for those who are suffering most bodily, but for all of us, because we're all, as I say, wasting away. that the wasting away might be accompanied by this ongoing, unstoppable inner renewal. And I think it is important to relate it to the preoccupation. This isn't inevitable. It's inevitable that we will waste away outwardly. I don't think it's inevitable that we will be renewed day by day. And sometimes you do see believers where the renewal doesn't seem to be happening. Sometimes believers can be embittered and become resentful. It's as we look to the things that are unseen. It's as we fix our thoughts on the future. It's as we do that, that the inner renewal will take place. Let's encourage this in one another. Let's pray for this in one another. And let's look for this in one another. It's inner renewal, even as outwardly we decay. Amen.